Today in Studio 360, the king of reality TV takes on the king of kings.
Oh, son.
Lady, I believe your son is the promised king of his people. What is his name?
His name is Jesus.
Mark Burnett and his wife and co-producer Roma Downey bring the New Testament to the big screen. And Son of God is doing boffo business.
It's a great story filled with drama and intrigue and all the ingredients that make up a good program.
I'll also talk about a movie that's pushing digital effects into uncanny territory. The makers of The Hunger Games are creating totally new scenes of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman.
This is the revolution, and you are the Mockingjay.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That and more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, I'm going to talk with one of my favorite living composers, the godfather of ambient, a man who makes music that's pretty and serene, but deeply intelligent. In other words, sublime. If Harold Budd's music doesn't open you up and calm you down, maybe nothing can. That's later this hour. But first...
You have been our mission from the beginning.
The plan was always to get you out.
Half the tributes were in on it. This is the revolution, and you are the Mockingjay.
When Philip Seymour Hoffman died last month, like everyone, I was shaken and saddened by the terrible waste. I thought about all his remarkable performances I'd seen, from the talented Mr. Ripley to Capote to The Master. His most recent job was in the third installment of the blockbuster Hunger Games series, playing the character called Plutarch Heavensby, the mastermind of the games. It's a major role, and he had important scenes left to shoot. A big problem for the movie makers. But instead of a rewrite to accommodate the missing scenes, the Hunger Games producers are said to be attempting a 21st century solution, creating a digital version of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, whose performance they will computer animate from scratch and cut into the movie. The studio and filmmakers aren't discussing it publicly, but to get some sense of how this unprecedented feat could be done, I'm joined today by Steve Pregg. As a special effects supervisor at Digital Domain in Los Angeles, he is an expert in creating virtual humans. Steve, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So just to make clear to our listeners, you are not working on the Hunger Games movies, but you have worked on similar projects, including The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, the Brad Pitt movie, for which you won an Oscar. What did you learn by working on that film and its extraordinary effects about animating actors realistically?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that for creating a synthetic character, you know, making someone who's just human is the most difficult thing that we've tried to do in computer graphics. And anything that is even, you know, slightly wrong with it causes a dip into what's known as the uncanny valley, which is a horrible place where when something gets close to human looking but doesn't quite make it, it becomes actually repulsive rather than pretty reasonably acceptable. The reasons that we typically find that something falls in the uncanny valley show up as things that you would typically see in a cadaver, you know, distant stare, mm-hmm. miscolored skin. And I got to imagine from a point of view of evolution that, you know, we would be naturally designed to stay away from that or fear it for
That's
reasons of disease or whatever.
And so as you're working on trying to make, let's say, Brad Pitt look ancient in Benjamin Button, are there moments where you have a bit of film and you go, no, that's creepy. That's not perfect enough, and you have to go back to the drawing board and say, how can we make that better?
Pretty much every shot goes through that
really?
At some point. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The trick is figuring out what's causing it. And, you know, there tends to be a lot of finger pointing between, is it the lighting? Is it the compositing? Is it the animation? And even once something gets fixed, say in animation, then maybe that, you know, sheds light on some issue that is in compositing or is in lighting. So it's definitely a sort of, you know, circular process of iterating over and over and over until everyone kind of feels like it's okay.
Now, with the Hunger Games and what they're proposing to do, and I want to again make clear that this is speculation since you're not involved with the film, the challenge is to replicate how Philip Hoffman looked months ago and in the rest of the film. What are the basic ways that could be done, what they're proposing to do of creating a whole new scene with this digital actor? How might that be done?
Well, I mean, you know, typically what we would do if we had access to an actor is we do a bunch of, you know, very high resolution scans that gives us geometric data as well as texture reference, you know, what their skin tones are. I don't know if any of that data has been captured for Philip Seymour Hoffman, either on this movie or in the past. If they don't have that, you know, there's going to be a lot of artistic interpretation of looking at images of him, either, you know, stills or moving.
And would you, I mean, if you were doing it, I mean, would it make sense to shoot one person to be the physical body that you then digitally animate the face differently and then somebody else to be the voice actor?
I would definitely, you know, get somebody to play the body. Whether or not you use the same person for the face, people don't necessarily realize that the body motion and body language is actually extremely tied to the actual voice performance and head motion. So extracting those two things is actually a pretty big challenge. And, you know, one of the things that I think that they're going to be facing, which I'm not sure how you would ever really solve, is what would Philip Seymour Hoffman have brought to that role that day while filming? I mean, that's something that no one can ever answer, right?
Yeah. Well, and that in this case is the it makes the bar, it seems to me, that much higher because he was such an extraordinary actor, and it's not easy to replicate because of what he, as you say, could bring on a given day.
You know, I think the success of something like that is extremely dependent on the viewer. If they go this route and, you know, people see it, there'll be people that buy into it. There'll be people, I think, that don't. I mean, I've shown people video footage of a real person and told them it was CG, and they pick it apart. You know, they tell you what's wrong with
really?
It.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. If they do it justice and, you know, everyone's on board and, you know, even if you could ask him, are you okay with this? And he said yes, there'll be people that say this is immoral or this isn't good or whatever. So,
Steve Pregg, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Pregg is a special effects supervisor for Digital Domain in Los Angeles. So tell us what you think. Does creating this digital version of the late Philip Seymour Hoffman strike you as dubious ethically, creepy, or just show business? You can leave a comment at studio360.org. It's March. You've probably already forgotten your New Year's resolution, if you bothered to make one. But a few of our listeners are feeling a little extra pressure to keep theirs. At the end of last year, we called out for your creative New Year's resolutions. And we're following a few of you as you make them happen. The rock and roller Mike Doty said he was going to turn the Book of Revelation into a musical. A lawyer named Adrienne Ognebine told us she planned to start painting after years away from the canvas. Julie Bailey is crafting and performing a stand-up comedy routine. And today, our final creative New Year's resolution maker, Gabriel Walker of Maysville, Kentucky.
My New Year's resolution is to stop sound designing for other people and then to go back to being a musician in an ensemble playing live music.
You don't have to learn how to play an instrument, I presume.
No. No, I've been playing the guitar for about 40 years. I play fingerstyle jazz, mostly chord melody kind of stuff.
And as you think about doing this over the next 10 months, what's the biggest challenge you think you face?
What I'm concerned about is I'm working with other musicians, which I haven't done in quite some time, and getting that musical language together. I'm also concerned about singing. I mean, I had great voice teachers in graduate school and in undergraduate school, but I let my voice kind of go. It's not what it once was.
So you're going to need some great musicians. Are there enough musicians around to create your band?
You know, I don't think so. The musicians here are quite good, but we play stuff that is so different. But my ultimate goal is to get to Louisville, and there, my sister, who is a gigging violinist out of Cleveland, plays in Louisville a lot. She's connected to the music scene. She's making introductions for me, and things are actually starting to take shape.
Great.
So when the weather breaks, I'm headed to Louisville.
No, Louisville is a hip place. I like it a lot. And what do you see your specific year-end 2014 goal being?
Well, by December, what I'm planning to do is to have a small ensemble together, hopefully acoustic musicians. I think a reasonable goal would be a 6-song set and to play, say, a showcase.
Do you know any song that yet is going to be part of that set, or you think probably will be?
Yeah, I mean, I'm right now working on a finger-style arrangement, a chord melody arrangement of What's New.
Terrific. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I apologize in advance for the fact that we'll be hounding you during the year.
Hound away. I need the motivation.
Great. Gabriel Walker lives in Maysville, Kentucky, and listens to Studio 360 on podcast.
What's new? How is the world treating you?
You can keep up with all four of our brave listeners and their resolutions all year long at studio360.org.
Lovely as ever, I must admit. What's new?
Coming up right now in Studio 360, I'll talk with reality TV producer Mark Burnett, the man behind Survivor and Donald Trump's Apprentice, who's turned the story of Jesus into a new movie with his wife and co-producer Roma Downey.
I'm just a real person and I make real mistakes. And I think that that was something that we wanted to show, that these guys didn't know they were in the Bible. They were just real people with flaws like us.
The creators of the new Christian blockbuster Son of God, that's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. We kicked off the year with a challenge. Scare us. It was for our Super Short Film Fest.
Wes Craven presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
We asked you to make 30-second horror films, and you made tons of them. We've got over 300 submissions.
You're brilliant! We don't have to deal with that little genius anymore.
It's okay, Mama. I fixed him.
Our judge, Master of Suspense Wes Craven, will be back next week to announce a winner and the runners-up. Until then, you can see our staff's 10 favorite scary shorts at studio360.org. Prepare yourself for the horrors of torture, murder, and selfies.
Studio 360.
Mark Burnett pretty much invented reality TV as we know it.
I'm a redneck, and I don't know corporate world at all. And corporate world ain't gonna work out here in the push.
No, and I'm not talking corporate world. I'm talking creating a team.
He made huge hits out of Survivor, The Voice, The Apprentice.
You're fired.
But his latest big show, and a surprise success last year, was something else entirely. A 10-hour miniseries called The Bible. Now Burnett and his wife Roma Downey have carved a feature film out of that series called Son of God. It's the first real biblical epic in a couple of generations, and last weekend it opened strong, taking in more than $26 million at the box office.
The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us.
Oh, son.
That was the biggest show of the year, 2013. One of Roma's favourite headlines was CNN that said, God beats zombies in reference to Walking Dead.
Yeah. And it is that large. It was as big a hit.
It was, and in Canada, the Bible beat hockey.
My God, that sounds blasphemous. I'm wondering about, as a film, as a two-hour-plus film, what your models were or the precedents that were influential.
Well, certainly, I think as children, we saw all the oldies, all the old sandals and donkeys movies of the past. We know that Jesus had not been on the big screen for almost 10 years to the weekend since Passion of the Christ opened.
The Mel Gibson movie.
And it's been almost 50 years since The Greatest Story Ever Told, which really was the last time the life of Christ played out in the whole journey of his life. So we felt that there's a whole new generation here that will want to see this story on the big screen.
You mentioned The Passion of the Christ. Given that that was the last big and hugely successful film about Jesus that came out, did you say, okay, it went wrong here and here and here, and we're going to do this differently in such and such a way?
Well, I think that the difference, obviously, that movie dealt with just 3 days at the end of Jesus' life, and we wanted here to present the grand narrative of his life.
And given that it is the New Testament, which gets into more particular doctrinal issues and things than the Bible in general, is there a particular denomination or church that guides your faith?
We actually worked on this, by the way, across the Catholic Church with Cardinal Worrell from the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., Archbishop Gomez, and then on the evangelical side with Rick Warren and Joel Osteen, Bishop Jakes. So we've been across all denominations.
So as you were talking to Roman Catholics and the evangelical Christians, and I presume people in between, did you ever get notes like, maybe not? Or did any Jewish groups say, you make the Jews look pretty bad here? Did you get any negative criticism?
No. Well, first of all, we got lots of notes back over a four-year period. On the Jewish side, we worked with the Anti-Defamation League, Abraham Foxman, very closely, and really understood what were the moments of sensitivity. And by the way, I'll tell you, Abraham Foxman knows the Gospels really, really well in a scholarly way. And so things that we did, which were just obvious to do, as John opens the movie Son of God, some of his first lines are about our Jewish nation.
Right. He's the narrator.
Under Roman occupation. Jesus is mainly referred to as rabbi or teacher. It's very clear there are no Christians. There's Jews and there's Romans. You know, we were so gratified by the notes and really took action.
Huh.
And so, you know, we got a written endorsement from Abe Foxman.
Yeah, just yesterday, Mr. Foxman issued a statement saying that he felt Son of God had been very sensitively told, and he thought that the movie would bring about a great healing after, you know, what he says was the damage done by Passion of the Christ.
Let's listen to a clip from Your Son of God, where Jesus performs one of his most well-known miracles, the one involving loaves and fishes.
Our Father in heaven feeds the birds of the air. How much more will he give to you? Put God first and everything else will follow. If you hunger for righteousness, you will be filled. Through me.
That's Diogo Morgado as Jesus in the movie Son of God. You seem to have gone to great lengths to achieve authenticity in the production design. What do I know? I wasn't there 2,000 years ago, but it looks pretty great. Jesus' followers and all the non-Romans and citizens around are Middle Eastern looking. They're dark-skinned and dark-haired. Jesus, this actor Morgado, is sort of light-haired, fair-skinned, European-looking. Why make that casting choice?
We were just a few weeks away from beginning filming, and we had not yet cast the role of Jesus. And to say that we were nervous would be an understatement.
That's an important role.
It was going to be the most important piece of casting, obviously, for the movie, maybe of our whole careers. We knew that we wanted an actor that would have physical strength, presence and charisma on screen, but also that could portray a tenderness and a kindness. And we looked at hundreds of actors, and through a series of amazing coincidences, we discovered Diogo Morgado. He's Portuguese, so I think he possibly might be the first Latin Jesus on the big screen. His performance is absolutely beautiful.
Well, I'm interested also in your own faith, though, if I can get more presumptuous, I guess. And where, for instance, on the spectrum of every word in the Bible is literally factually true to, yeah, some of it is and some of it's allegorical and some of it's mythic. Where do you guys fall on that spectrum?
Oh, no, it's true. We don't think it's allegorical at all.
The universe and earth and man created in 6 days, and we mean 6 earth days and all.
No, it's our faith.
Huh.
And you?
No, I don't believe that, certainly.
Oh, okay.
But have you always been such literalists about the Bible and your faith?
I'm born and raised Catholic in Northern Ireland, was educated by the Sisters of Mercy, or as we jokingly used to refer to them as the Sisters of No Mercy. My oldest brother is a priest, and I have, enjoyed and loved my walk with the Lord all these years. And I think that the success of the Bible series speaks more to a hunger for hope and a hunger for connection to God that we have. I think that so many things are thrown at us on any given day, particularly being here in the city, billboards and stimulus and, you know, commercials and noise and all of the things that come at us in any given moment. You know,
hey, Los Angeles is just as Sodom and Gomorrah is New York.
No, everywhere is. No, I'm not, I have no judgment of it. I'm just saying that it's noisy.
Yeah.
And in the noisiness, sometimes we don't hear, you know, the still quiet places within that connect us to the grander sweep of God, of the God that I think we all are looking for.
Well, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you about, here you are, these very out Christians in Hollywood, a place not known for its pious Christianity, frankly, show business run by non-believers. Is it ever awkward for you to be like, We're these.
Pious is a. I don't know. Pious seems to me like it has a sort of self-righteous quality.
Okay,
to
choose your.
And I,
sure.
You know, we are imperfect people. We're just doing the best we can.
Sure.
You know? We're noisy Christians.
Exactly.
Yes, we are very noisy.
And so, does that ever like keep it on the down low?
The opposite, in fact. We, you know, are very close friends with people across faiths. Many people come to our house, and there's been some. Fantastically well-discussed dinner parties at our house, you know, every few weeks. We always bless the food, and people of all faiths respect that as we do them.
So you have this huge body of enormously successful television work, including Survivor, The Voice, The Apprentice, Sarah Palin's Alaska, more. But it seems like Son of God has been this more personal project. Does that mean you're prouder of this movie than anything else you've done?
I don't know if proud is the right word, but certainly enjoyed this process and enjoyed the reception we've had to the movie. But, you know, I've had lots of fun. I mean, like it's like with Roma, got to believe, touched by an angel. I mean, 10 years, the number one show on TV, it's a huge experience. Survivor, that first summer of Survivor, 72 million people turned into the finale. The most people that had watched television in the summer since Sonny and Cher in 73 or something like that.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I've never said that to you before, but that's a true fact. And then The Voice. How many people you think told me I was an idiot and that why would you make a music show when American Idol is so dominant? And by the way, Mark, what makes Idol work is the humiliation factor. You don't have a humiliation factor.
You have no Simon Cowell on
right.
The Voice.
And yet, what is the massive hit on television for music shows? The Voice. So I like to do things that I want to do. And I don't even hear other people telling me their opinions of what they think, because I just think you should go do it yourself.
Well, it's interesting. All as I was thinking about, okay, what is similar? What draws all of your work together? Obviously, the, as you call it, unscripted drama, the reality shows, as most people call them, are of a kind. But then I thought, oh, no, how those are also like the Bible and Son of God is you do things fearlessly and you do them and they work.
Another commonality, I guess, from this movie Son of God and all of our other work between Roma's Touched by an Angel and my shows, they're all family friendly. We have big audiences, but I think what the message here is, family friendly really works if you want big audiences. NFL is family friendly, the most watched thing in America.
Hugely violent, but yes, family friendly.
That's a sport.
Well, we managed to get a PG-13 rating for Son of God because we are hoping and encouraging families to come together to experience the film.
I do want to talk about the values that are celebrated in your television programs. I mean, The Apprentice celebrates a certain worldly competition, and the winner has to be shrewd, sometimes to the point of dishonesty. Richard, the winner on the first season of Survivor, was a jerk.
But here's the interesting thing. He never lied to anybody.
Right.
So
he tricked them, but he didn't lie.
Didn't lie to them. And that's actually how he won. Because Survivor is a very moral game. You can manipulate your way to near the end in most endeavors in life. But you won't win when you're relying upon other people. Survivor, you get that $1 million given to you by the very people that you eliminated. You have to stand there in front of a jury
right.
of people that you have eliminated.
Yeah.
How you did that, not the fact that you did it, it's a game. Everyone gets the game. They don't mind you being clever, but it's outright lying to them and betraying them. People tend to never, ever win. So there's a big moral play in that. An Apprentice, I mean, for the last 5 years, it's raised maybe $100 million for charity.
Right.
So
even though Donald Trump is about the most un-Jesus Christ-like human I can imagine.
Donald's mum, Scottish mum.
Well, that's
very
extreme.
Very, 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 very really.
I mean, I believe I'm a great lover of Jesus' teachings. And Donald, I'm sorry, he's the opposite.
He's been a good friend to our family.
We don't judge people. And he has been very honest and reliable to us, and it's a big charity show.
So I understand you are now working on another Sandals and Donkeys series, this one for NBC, about what, early Christians?
Sandals and Donkeys.
No, your wife's phrase.
She said we don't be sandals and donkeys. It's the old style.
Okay.
I would say yes, but we are. Yeah, we're doing AD. Great storyline. If you think of it, in that first couple of decades after the crucifixion, must have been the most tumultuous time in history. As Judea came apart, if you have to give a log line, I don't, maybe how did 12 guys take down Rome? Because there was 12 apostles, obviously.
How interesting. So you really are proving that explicitly religious programming can work in the mass media in America.
Yeah. Well, I think it was back to that there is a hunger for it, you know. It's a great story filled with drama and intrigue and all the ingredients that make up a good program.
And with this, you didn't have to pay, you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John aren't members of the Writers Guild, so you didn't have to cover that. Mark Brunetta and Roma Downey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Son of God is in theaters now. There's a very different kind of message about resurrection that somebody has been planting around Philadelphia for years, carved into tiles that are placed in the street. The message refers to the 19th century philosopher Alfred Toynbee, and it reads, Toynbee idea in movie 2001, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter. Got that? The cryptic message, whatever it means exactly, has become an inspiration to artists in Philadelphia. We sent WHYY's Peter Crimmins out to try to explain what these Toynbee tiles are all about.
I'm standing at the corner of 19th and Vine Streets in Philadelphia. I'm right across the street from the main branch of the Free Library. And right here, in the middle of the crosswalk, in the middle of the street, is a Toynbee tile. It's all covered with dirt, but it's a single linoleum rectangle. It's about the size of a license plate. And someone has cut out letters by hand. It says Toynbee Idea, and then it says in movie 2001, Resurrect Dead on Planet Jupiter. Now, there are dozens of these around Philadelphia, maybe more. Old ones wear away after a while. New ones sometimes reappear. It wouldn't take you long to find one if you were the kind of person who looked down at the street while walking around a city. And one of those people is Raj Haldar. He goes by Lush Life, and he made the music you're hearing right now.
A lot of it was about a very sort of loping rhythm track walking down the street with a bop. I started walking with
the bird, wishing we never die, never be lost. The first part of the song, this part, is about the first line of the message, which is simply Toynbee Idea. It refers to a 20th century historian named Alfred Toynbee, who wrote about the reincarnation of the soul and the possibility of life after death.
That afterlife had not come to pass, but it would, thanks to technology. And for some reason, that would happen with reconstituted molecules on Jupiter.
Yeah, Jupiter. Somehow the planet Jupiter got involved in this. For 20 years now, these tiles have been showing up in Philadelphia and in other cities around the world. They've been seen in New York, in Chicago, in Santiago de Chile. Still, no one knows who does it. It's assumed that this guy, and he's probably a guy, surreptitiously drops these linoleum plaques on the street and lets the weight of passing cars drive it into the asphalt. Lush Life used the tiles as a way to test the limits of hip-hop. He created a long, meditative, four-part suite that matches the four-part structure of the Toynbee tile message. This is the second part of the song. The second line of the tiles message is in movie 2001. Sometimes it's in Kubrick's 2001. It refers to the film by Stanley Kubrick about the possible origins of life and a supercomputer who develops a mind of its own.
I ended up using a quote from Hal as the chorus section where he's saying, Dave, stop, stop, Dave. It's all about being propulsive.
The meaning of the message in the Toynbee tiles is up to interpretation. Is this an elaborate art project, or is it an obsession of a madman?
I come from a sort of background being really interested in graffiti, and my sense of it is that it doesn't really have an artistic motivation. It seems to me to be all about communicating a singular idea.
Without knowing what they mean or who made them, an army of fans has developed around these tiles. One of them is Justin Dewar.
I first noticed the Toynbee tiles probably right around the time I moved to the city, so 93.
When Dewar arrived on Philadelphia's punk scene, no one was talking about the Toynbee tiles, but he felt a certain kinship with the unknown tiler. They both worked on personal projects that were, quite frankly, a little bit weird. Dewar's first band was called Eulogy, and they made music by breaking into nearby empty industrial buildings and banging on the abandoned equipment.
So we went to an abandoned oil refinery, and we would climb inside these big oil drums and bang around in there because the acoustics are really crazy.
Dewar released the music on cassettes with the hand-labeled title Resurrect Dead. That is the third line of the Toynbee tile message.
I saw it as related in spirit, not directly. You know, the tiles and their message were really cryptic and off the radar, and so was the music that we were doing.
Eulogy eventually broke up, and Dewar went on to play with other bands, but he stayed with the Toynbee tiles for 10 years, photographing and cataloging every instance of them he could find. His efforts have come a long way. There's now an unofficial Google map of all the known Toynbee tiles listed by location and condition. And Dewar was the subject of a documentary film called Resurrect Dead, The Mystery of the Toynbee Tiles, which won an award at Sundance in 2011. And now you can buy a t-shirt, silkscreened, with a Toynbee tile. This is the fourth and final movement of the Toynbee Suite. The Toynbee tile message may simply be an homage to David Mamet, the playwright. Mamet wrote a one-act play called 4 a.m., in which a late-night radio talk show host gets a call from a man who talks about Alfred Toynbee, Stanley Kubrick, and reincarnation on the planet Jupiter. The radio show host eventually shuts him down. And it's hard to believe that someone would spend this long dropping David Mamet fan mail into the street. And it's even harder to believe that he, or she, hasn't been found out. Here in Philadelphia, we've grown proud of the Toynbee tiles, even if that tiler might be some kind of nut job. It's the lure of that unanswered question, why? Why do you do it? It keeps artists like Lush Life coming back to the mystery that's in their own backyard.
Back to life again. Back up on the corner spot, either on the block, back on the mic again.
Both of us, in our own ways, are kind of tirelessly pursuing one static goal in the face of glacial amounts of time. For him, it's like, you know, 20-odd years of wanting to communicate the Toynbee philosophy to the world. And for me, it's how I want to make rap records. And in that way, I feel like I really do relate to the Toynbee Tyler.
Lush Life does not get the last word on his own song. He puts the mic down 2 minutes before the end of the song and lets the clarinet take it out.
That's how all rap songs end. 2 minutes of clarinet.
I'm Peter Crimmins for Studio 360.
The music of Harold Budd is beautiful and blissful. But please, whatever you do, don't call it New Age.
I used to go into record stores when there was such a thing and complain and get me out of New Age.
I'll talk with composer Harold Budd just ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. When I'm not a radio host, I'm a writer. And when I'm writing, I listen to music. But I can't write listening to music with lyrics or dumb music or, most of the time, music with a lot of drama. So when I discovered Harold Budd at the end of the last century, his music became my go-to workaday soundtrack. People call Harold Budd the godfather of ambient music, an honorific I understand he doesn't love. He plays the piano with a long sustain of notes that hang in the air, as you're hearing. It doesn't insist and grab your attention, but if you do, it transports you. At 77, Budd's career has taken him from bebop jazz to avant-garde minimalism to the existentially pretty music, his phrase, that he's now famous for. He's spent almost 40 years defining a genre through collaborations with artists like Brian Eno and the Cocteau Twins. The first ever career-spanning collection of Harold Budd's music, Wind in Lonely Fences, 1970 to 2011, is out now on All Saints Records, and he is here with me. Harold Budd, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here.
So on my iTunes, where I have many of your albums bought and paid for and in rotation, as I say, your music is classified in 8 different genres, and seemingly randomly. It's alternative, it's classical, it's electronica dance, new age, rock, unclassifiable, and unknown genre. Does that please you?
I think it's absurd. I think it's hilarious, actually.
Well, and it's interesting, the term that I've read you dislike, ambient, which is so often applied to your music, isn't even one of them that your music was categorized by Apple. Why don't you like your music being called ambient?
My reaction is very visceral and immediate, and maybe it's just being called something,
yeah,
anything that annoys the hell out of me, honestly.
Just having it all be distilled into a single word.
Yeah, exactly.
Seems, yeah.
Well, you know, it. I remember 20, 25 years ago, it used to be New Age.
That must have felt even worse, I would guess.
That was the worst thing that I have. I mean, that was so ludicrous and so awful.
Yeah.
That I used to go into record stores when there was such a thing.
Yeah.
And complain and get me out of New Age.
And would they do so?
Sometimes.
And when you were a kid, when you were young, was there a sort of aha moment where you decided, okay, music is my thing. This has moved me. This is what I want to do.
I can't really explain what happened or what it is, but at some point I fell in love with jazz.
Uh-huh.
And to be honest with you, I think that was largely a product of my rebellion against my family, my background. And I fell in love with black culture, and especially bebop. And that pretty much set me off in this direction of otherness. I'll put it that way. I wasn't angry. You know, I wasn't really pissed off at anybody.
You don't sound angry now.
No, I'm not. I'm not. Believe me, I'm one of the happiest guys in the world.
But when you say otherness, you mean sort of not being part of some mainstream
against
ladder.
Against the grain.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I was never career-oriented. I was never oriented towards anything except what really struck my fancy. And my fancy was, frankly, artists and what they did.
Your music from your first decade as a composer in the 60s sounds very different from what we who have listened to your music since are used to.
I was looking. I didn't know which way to go. I hadn't found my own voice at all.
Right. And I want to, the new collection has one of those early-ish pieces from 1971 that I want to play a little bit of called The Oak of the Golden Dreams.
Sure.
And that goes on for 18 minutes with very, very few changes or anything
like
that.
It goes on forever, doesn't it?
It does go on forever. What were you trying to do other than in some way, you know, playing the kind of music that the avant-garde thought should be played at the time?
My friend at CalArts, where I was teaching, Charlemagne Palestine, kind of introduced me to the Buchla synthesizer. This is pre-digital.
Right.
And this was my kind of introduction to it, and I wanted to kind of look and see what I could do with that.
And then you stopped writing music in 1970 and then started up again 2 years later, and it was something completely different and more or less what I know of you as doing. It was pretty. What happened? Was there a kind of epiphany that you had?
Yes, there was. And it, two kinds, negative and positive. The negative one was getting sick and tired of avant-garde music. It was so self-congratulatory and so insular and so boring. And I just didn't want to participate in that world anymore, period. And so I stopped. And luckily, I made a friendship with my closest friend, who was Daniel Entz. And he had coined the term post-avant-garde. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, that's exactly what I mean.
And by that, we mean you're not going back to trying to reproduce music of the 19th century, but you're not exactly doing the same thing that had been done in the middle of the 20th.
Exactly correct, yes.
Your best-known collaborator, I venture to say, is Brian Eno, who you met in the 1970s when he was making his clean break from his Roxy Music pop rock world, and you were making this clean break from academic avant-garde minimalist music. I want to play a little bit of the title track from the 1984 album you made with Brian Eno called The Pearl.
Sure.
That is The Pearl from Harold Budd's album of the same name with Brian Eno. How did you two find each other?
This is the story that I'm not really responsible for. But according to Brian, he was given a tape of a live performance of Madrigal's Over the Rose Angel. And he called me up and he asked me a funny question. He said, "Is this the kind of thing that you always do?" And my answer was, "Well, yes, it is." And he invited me over to London, my first trip to London. Did that change my life, my God.
Changed it in that the cool kids were suddenly paying attention to you, or changed it musically as well?
Yes. Not musically, no, but changed in terms of actually making a go of it in the real world.
Right.
Yeah.
10 years ago, you announced you were retiring, and you said you had nothing more to say, and you played these two big farewell concerts. And you've released, by my count, about a half a dozen records since then. So that retirement didn't work out.
No, it did not. And I was a fool to have said that or to haven't even thought it.
Yeah.
It was a very low point in my life. I was living alone in Joshua Tree, California. And my marriage was breaking up. And I felt dreadfully sorry for myself.
Mm.
And, that's really juvenile response, but I did. I felt sorry for myself.
Yep.
And my response was to tell everyone, I just kicked the can,
I'm taking the bases and going home.
Exactly correct. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. And what a dumb thing to have done, but I did it. And I'm sorry about that, but.
How long did it take you to sort of say, what did I do? I still want to make music.
Not very long at all. Even when I said it publicly, I thought to myself, God, Jesus Christ, Harold, you're making a real mistake. I'm thinking to myself, you haven't thought this through. What are you going to do? And the answer was, stop saying that, apologize and get the hell out of there.
And you say you were living out in the Joshua Tree Desert.
Yeah.
You grew up some in the Mojave Desert way out in California,
yeah,
both of which make people say, oh, this beautiful, serene music, the desert must inspire him. But I read no.
No, it doesn't. It does not. In fact, the desert is kind of a tough place to live. It's not,
I mean,
it's very attractive for tourists, but having to live there, man, that's a different bag of tricks altogether.
So if when I listen to your music, I should no longer imagine that it's evoking the desert perfection of Joshua Tree.
Absolutely correct. Thank you so much. I'm so glad we got that.
Cleared that up. Good. And do you intend to keep making records? No other retirements are going to be threatened?
Oh, God, no. Certainly not. No. None of that.
Good. Well, I want to keep having new Harold Budd records to buy, so thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Harold Budd, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Been my pleasure, believe me.
Wind in Lonely Fences, 1970 to 2011, a two-disc compilation of Harold Budd's music, is out now on All Saints Records. That's just about it for this hour, but before we go, we all have those quotes that inspire our curiosity and creativity. We jot them down in notebooks and on Post-its. We carry them in our wallets. We use them in wedding toasts. At Studio 360, we've decided to call those spark quotes, and we want to share some of your favorites on the air. Here's our first quote from Megan in Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, my name is Megan, and I listen to Studio 360 on WNYC in New York City. And this is a quote from Pablo Picasso. Every child is an artist. The problem is staying an artist when you grow up.
It's easy. Just record yourself on your phone, or even better, your desktop or laptop computer. Tell us your name, where you listen to the show, and then read your short quote. You can upload your audio to us at studio360.org. We'll take the best quotes we get, set them to music, and feature them on the show and online all year long. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you listen again next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
We ask you for your scary short films no longer than 30 seconds.
I didn't do anything.
And you sent us hundreds.
Who's that?
No toys during the lesson.
Wes Craven announces the winner of our Scary Short Film Fest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.